Welcome to this 11KBW podcast, a DP Privacy and e-Privacy case law roundup by Robin Hopkins. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference at the Kelvin Theatre, IET, London Savoy Place. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Good morning, everyone. Exciting times in data protection. How's that for a banal opening sentence? I actually wrote it down and then crossed it out, but anyway, I've said it now. As Anya pointed out in her introduction to our session this morning, we have a whole host of important and rapidly developing strands of data protection law and practice that are really unsettled. They're there for the making. They are works in progress as we speak. To that end, we have a hugely exciting and spicy and varied menu coming up today of data protection issues, on top of David Glenn's privacy session focusing on media and Article 8 privacy rights. And focusing in on data protection specifically, we'll hear from Anya on civil litigation, from Julian Milford on developments at the EU level, both case law and, for example, the new and evolving e-privacy legislative regime. We'll also hear from Tim Pitt-Payne on the exciting frontiers of life after Brexit, cutting-edge technology, and so on. As I say, some delicious, spicy, exotic issues served up by a Michelin star array of speakers. But before we get there, I think it's important to stop, take stock, and start with some more bland and everyday fare. The porridge and rice, the artisan sourdough maybe of data protection. And don't worry, if bland and everyday is what you're after, I am your man. What on earth am I talking about? I'm talking about things that I like to think of as the nuts and bolts of how data protection needs to be applied in our everyday contexts. Concepts like personal data, controllership, the sorts of procedural safeguards and documentary work that we are now quite heavily laden with when it comes to implementing our data protection responsibilities. I'm talking about subject access requests that continue to delight or haunt us, data sharing arrangements and how we go about satisfying ourselves that any sort of partnership data sharing arrangement is actually fit for purpose. Keeping an eye also on what the ICO is doing if we end up getting things wrong. Those are the sorts of issues that I'm going to focus on this morning, and what I'll do is try and mine some of the recent interesting cases, mainly domestic ones, but not exclusively, to see what sorts of insights we can extract with an eye on that practical nuts and bolts approach that I've outlined. The first case, which does deliver a whole host of interesting insights for us, is the case of Bridges and the Chief Constable of South Wales Police. Now, that is a case that did get quite a lot of media coverage. Most of you probably picked up something about it. It's on the very hot topic of facial recognition technology. As you will probably have picked up from when the judgment came out, roughly the dispute is this. A police force has a list of suspects, of baddies that it wants to track down. It has some photographic images of them. It wants to harness big crowd-related opportunities in public spaces, for example, football matches, when you'll get lots and lots of people coming out onto the streets, and it wants to try and track down, search for the needles in the haystack to find some of these wanted folks. So sets up a facial recognition system that scans everyone who comes past a certain area. What it does is effectively looks for a match. It hones in on the face of the person it's scanning, does a match against the list of potential baddies. If you are not on that list, your information is not retained. Your photograph is immediately binned, or at least in some negligible time period. It makes its way to the bin, and the police don't hold onto it and sit on and build a big database of everyone's face. It's only if you are on the list of baddies, if there is a match between your face and the suspect list, that something is done and you'll probably have someone coming over and having a word with you. A challenge was brought by someone, Mr. Bridges, who is not on the list of baddies. So he's in the category of faces scanned, data is binned, no match. The challenge was under both Article 8 of the European Convention and also for a breach of the DPA. Now, important to remember here that because we're in a law enforcement context, we're not in the GDPR. We are in Part 3 of the Data Protection Act 2018, which is implementing the Law Enforcement Directive. So it's important to be clear about where we are in terms of the data protection architecture with this case, and not automatically to read across from one to another. But that said, there are some insights, some really quite difficult concepts in this case that would apply or at least influence how we read GDPR aspects of our data protection world as well. The upshot is that the court dismissed Mr. Bridges' claim. Of course, it accepted that this system of automated facial recognition scanning did involve a privacy intrusion and the processing of personal data, but the court concluded that that was a justified privacy intrusion. And we'll look at some of the factors, but we need to bear in mind also that this case is subject to appeal, so we will get some more interesting insights as it unfolds. On the Article 8 claim, the court was satisfied not only that Article 8 was engaged, but that this was actually a significant privacy intrusion. Wouldn't be fair to characterise what was happening to the Mr. Bridges of the world as insignificant. You know, on one submission, you get a kind of, well, what's the problem, mate? You walk past, no match, photo not kept, end of story. There is no real meaningful privacy impact on you, is there? No, says the court, this is significantly intrusive in privacy terms. And one reason for that is that we are looking here at a biometric technology, a technology that uses biometric data for identification purposes. But, said the court, this intrusion was justified, was in accordance with the law because of the legal framework and protections that governed how the police were able to operate this system. And the privacy intrusion was limited in scope and duration, and the court considered it a proportionate way to proceed. We'll have a look at a few of those points under the data protection heading. Let's start, though, with the concept of personal data. As I say, a key aspect of our nuts and bolts of data protection. Is it personal data if you process some information, you don't know who the person is who you're processing it about, you do not care, you have no interest in ever finding out? And that's something that this case teases out, because as I explained in the introduction, the police say, we're only interested in the people on the baddies list, the suspect list. If you're not on there, congratulations, have a nice life. We don't care who you are. We have no intention of ascertaining your identity. The court engages with quite a detailed analysis of this question and says, well, there are two ways that apparently, and data that doesn't have your name attached to it, could fall within the definition of personal data. First, it could be because even though no name is attached, no obvious identifiers, indirect identifiability turns this into personal data. What we're talking about there is the old Breyer line of cases. Breyer, you say. I see some sage nodding. Breyer was a CJEU judgment from a few years ago that was about IP addresses, a public authority's harvesting of IP addresses of visitors to its website. Question there, okay, the public authority doesn't know who these people are who are visiting its website, but is it nonetheless personal data on the grounds that you could, if you tried, if you pieced it the IP address together with some other data, you could figure out who these people were? In Breyer, the court says, here is a test. If the identification is either prohibited by law or it involves so much disproportionate effort that it is practically impossible, and the upshot is that there is really an insignificant risk of identification, then the answer will be no, not personal data. So that's one way of thinking about the personal data question. the court in Bridges said, well, here, that's just not going to happen. Not going to be the case that the police are in practice either able or equipped to go and figure out who everyone is if they're not on the suspect list. But, says the court, that's not where you stop. When it comes to a system like this camera system I've been outlining, you don't just ask, could people actually go and figure out identities? Could they track down who Mr. Bridges is if they put their mind to it? What you need to think about is another aspect of the personal data analysis, and that is individuation or singling out. Now, this is something of an emerging frontier, quite a difficult concept to apply in lots of circumstances. The classic instance that's called out of articulating something like this comes from the judgments in Vidal Hall and Google, where as those who delved into it a few years ago will remember, one of the issues was, is there an arguable case that the browser-generated information that Google was processing in order to tailor adverts to people, is there an arguable case that that stuff counts as personal data, even though Google would say, we don't care what your name is or where you live, we're just not bothered. All we want to do is to use your browser information to put you into various buckets, and the buckets will kind of decide what kinds of adverts you get sent, and we never care about your identity. A similar line of reasoning applied in this case, and the court said, well, on this basis in the Bridges case, that sort of thing is what the police are doing. They may not care who Mr. Bridges is, but what they are trying to do is sift him out from the people they're really looking for. And that sifting out, that putting of people into categories that attract distinct attention was enough to render this information personal data. As I say, quite a difficult and developing aspect of personal data law and the concept of personal data, this individuation or singling out, but Bridges is one of our first developed judicial engagements with that. Just pausing on this concept of personal data, and by way of quick interlude, this is more of a reminder case rather than anything that has really bobbed up more recently. It's the judgments in the case of Lonsdale against NatWest. I think the judgment was handed down in the early part of 2019, but doesn't seem to have got very much coverage. So while we're on the topic of personal data, just to draw it to your attention, I do it because it's the sort of dispute that comes up quite a lot, especially in subject access contexts. It was about a man whose accounts were frozen by NatWest. He wanted to find out why that had happened. He made a subject access request in parallel with his claims. He wanted to get hold of information that explained why the bank had these suspicions about him and his activity on his personal accounts, how it went about making its account freezing decisions, what sorts of meetings it had to discuss his situation, and he also wanted to know who in fact attended those meetings. NatWest said, well, none of that stuff is personal data. That stuff is about our internal business thinking. Your account, Mr. Lonsdale, happens to be the kind of springboard for that. It happens to be the specific instance, but really what you're asking for is internal business-specific information. No, said the court, that does count as personal data in this context. And I draw it out as I say, by way of an interlude, building up our nuts and bolts understanding, looking at the personal data question from various angles. Another short interlude doesn't appear on your slide there because it's a judgment handed down yesterday afternoon by Mr. Justice Sarney in the High Court. It's a case of Scott against the LGBT Foundation, very new judgment under the DPA 98. What it engages with, if we need authority for this proposition, is that purely verbal disclosures, communications, are not caught by data protection law. One of the arguments being run in that case was that if information is in your head, you impart it to someone over the telephone and they then write it down, and you're doing it for that purpose. That's why you ring them up and say, you know, please add this to your records. Then you, the person making the call, are processing personal data because you are causing some other person to create a record. So Scott is a case that looks at that point about disputes as to purely verbal communications. It also looks at one of the processing conditions that doesn't get much airtime in court judgments, and that is the vital interests processing condition. So I think we'll get it up on Panopticon at some point, and one to add, jot onto your list of personal data considerations. Back to Bridges. We were talking about personal data. Another point to remember from Bridges is, of course, that we're not just looking at personal data, we're looking at sensitive, or what's under the GDPR we would call special category data, because we're in the realms of photographic technology that is intended to be used as a distinct identifier. It's biometric data. The court said, well, nonetheless, in this case, no breach of the first data protection principle. And remember, we've got a sort of confusing terminology swilling around here. First data protection principle is old DPA 98 language, but it's also pretty similar to the language used in the DPA 2018 for non-GDPR processing, for the law enforcement stuff. So that's why I'm continuing to use that term here. But of course, it's got a very good read across to the Article 5.1a principle in the GDPR. The reasons why the court thought, in broad terms, this was all proportionate, that this was fair, this was okay processing the system that I've outlined. One point, well, it's governed by an adequate legal framework of protections. Well, what framework, said Mr. Bridges? You can't just say, well, it's got to be governed by the DPA, because that would all be circular and it just wouldn't be enough. Court says, well, the DPA is part of a legal regime, but there were also specific and published police guidance documents on how information of that kind is processed. And those kinds of documents, codes of practice, can supplement the bedrock, the statutory regime of the DPA, and build an adequate legal regime that protects individuals' rights. Court also satisfied that there was adequate transparency. The police had said on their Twitter feed, their Facebook page, this is what we're going to be doing at Saturday's football match. We're going to be using this technology. It had leaflets and posters, big sign up apparently, above where the van doing the filming was situated. Court was satisfied that the police were only using this information for the very specific purpose I've outlined, that the cameras were not, for example, following everyone around wherever they might go. They had limited geographic reach and limited reach in terms of the fields of information that was being gathered. The police did very limited stuff with that. They only held on to that the material for a very, very short period of time, a swift deletion, and it didn't actually lead to anything bad happening by way of the wrong person being collared and hauled up to speak to a policeman. The court was also satisfied, and this was one that part of the judgment that did raise some eyebrows, that the test of strict necessity, which applies in the law enforcement parts of the DPA, strict necessity for the processing of biometric data, that test was satisfied. Now, as I say, some people looked at this and said, well, strict necessity must mean something higher than necessity, right? So how come you're just using the same analysis of ordinary necessity to get you home on strict necessity? What a strict ad. And that's something that I think the appellate stages of the litigation might help us with. Okay, classic data protect mining of a case for the more boring everyday data protection stuff. Never mind all the fun, interesting, big social issues about the use of facial technology from Bridges. What about the really cool stuff like appropriate policy documents and data protection impact assessments? That's what I want to hear about. And I'm actually serious about some of you are laughing, but anyway. The court did get into this issue that I think, at least from my experience and possibly from yours, vexes people quite a lot. They say, okay, I see that I'm doing lots of special category processing here. I need to have one of these appropriate policy documents in place. Can I do it on a post-it note? Because the stuff in the DPA seems pretty minimal. Can I just pull out a few lines from my privacy policy, put them and stick that on file? Is that okay? Mostly people end up saying, well, I don't know. What does it look like? What's good enough? Bridges is, to my knowledge, the first time a court's had to look at the appropriate policy document. And it broadly, where it comes out is to look at the police's one and think, well, that is pretty thin, you know. But I think it's probably okay. And partly that's because the legal requirements about appropriate policy documents are themselves at a pretty generic level. They're not very specific. There isn't very much guidance. The ICO is not yet able to churn out guidance on every aspect of the law. So in the absence of that, I'm going to cut you some slack, and I think your pretty bare-bones appropriate policy document is okay. That's where the court ends up on that point. Hooray, we all say. Post-it note is fine. I'm not sure that's the right conclusion to take from Bridges. It shows courts being unwilling at this early stage, I think, in the evolution of all this stuff, to take too hard a line. But I wouldn't want to throw caution to the wind about it. The same goes for data protection impact assessments, one of our new GDPR-era specific requirements. The court there says, well, it's got to be... The standard here is an objective one. You've got to do a proper DPIA. You can't just post-it note the thing. But when you have brought conscientious assessment to bear, basically, when you've tried, you've done your best, the court's not really going to intervene too much in whether or not you discharged your DPIA duty. Again, I think same self health warning as I've just given about appropriate policy documents. Don't leap to the conclusion, don't worry, no court will ever give me trouble about this. They'll just wave it through. I put as a last point on this slide, just because it quite often does come up, you know, what does a good DPIA look like? I'm not coming out to bat for anything as a particularly stellar example, but an interesting published example, because very few national projects, as far as I'm aware, published granular DPIAs. I give an example on that slide that if you found a project you were working on and wanted to have a look at what a government agency has felt comfortable, like this is a good, robust, publishable DPIA, have a look at that one for the National ANPR Service. Okay, briefly, next concept in our building blocks. What does data controller mean? Now, this can be pretty quick stuff because it's really hammering home a line of case law that we've become pretty familiar with. It's the Fashion ID judgment from the CJEU, middle of last year. Online retail, online fashion website embeds a Facebook like button. If you like, Facebook then ends up processing some personal data about your interaction with that website. Question, is the website, the retailer, is it processing individuals' personal data, even though it doesn't know or care who is pushing that like button? It's not bothered, doesn't ever hold that information, doesn't get hold of it itself. Is it a controller? Given the drift of case law, Facebook fan pages, the Jehovah's Witness judgments, and so on, the unsurprising answer from the court is yes. You will be a controller, even if you never get your hands on the personal data in question. Never touch it, never do anything with it yourself, but you can be a controller if what? If you exert influence over the processing of personal data and you thereby participate in determining the purpose. Exerting influence, participating, these are quite broad terms. Another consideration, of course, is follow the money, follow the benefit. If you have set up a system whereby your hands never actually touch the personal data, someone else is doing that, but you are deriving some kind of commercial or other benefit from it, you may well be a controller of that processing. So if I'm a controller, does it mean I'm on the hook for every bit of processing that happens? Panic, you can imagine from the website, I run a sort of fashion website, pretty limited fare. Because I'm found to be a controller of something to do with the transmission of data to Facebook, am I now on the hook for everything that Facebook does with all of that data? If so, serious problems for me in terms of my exposure. Answer, no. And this is useful when we come to thinking in our GDPR world about joint controllership. The court reminds us in Fashion ID, joint controllership doesn't mean that everybody who is a controller is equally on the hook for everything. What you need to do is find out, okay, you're a controller, but what processing operations are you actually a controller for? Answer here with this website seems to be only for the act of processing that transmits data from my webpage to Facebook. That's where the line comes down. Everything after that, I'm not a controller. Facebook is. Complain to them if you're not happy. But you can only criticize me for that processing operation. I think what that draws out is the importance of being clear when there are multiple controllers in the frame, Who is accepting responsibility for which processing operations? Where's the buck going to stop with each stage of the life cycle? Subject access requests, just a few brief points on this. One question, of course, that comes up all the time, proportionality of searches. Have the courts had anything good to say about this? Dawson Damer and Taylor Wessing, what? You say, isn't this a case from 5 years ago? Is this guy just dredging up stuff from his back catalogue? Well, I feel like that as well. You're right, it's a case from 5 years ago. It's the case that will not die. It went up to the Court of Appeal. That churned out propositions like you can't dismiss a subject access request based on the apparent motivation of the data subject, except in very limited circumstances. That's the sort of thing we got first time round. Case goes back down. High Court hears it again. Both parties have appealed again. So it's going back up to the Court of Appeal for another outing. Some points that emerge, but bear in mind that we'll get further appellate judgments. The courts found on proportionality that searching a stack of paper files was proportionate on the evidence before it, and the paper files were organised in a way that did count as a relevant filing system. But, better news for controllers, the backup IT system fell outside the bounds of proportionality. So one to keep an eye on, but mixed bag from a controller's point of view. I will skip the brief reference to Hussein, which is more by way of wry observation than anything especially useful. Subject access requests still, perhaps more interesting than any recent judgments, is the ICO's draft guidance on subject access requests. We'll get something promulgated later this year, but what's the direction of travel? Just a few nuggets that I pull out. And they are broadly under two headings. One is timing, that issue that always vexes everyone. Subject access request lands before I even open it. Oh, can I have the extra time, please? It's really, that's what everyone reaches for, understandably. The ICO gives some very granular guidance on how you apply the 1 month ordinary time limit, and do look it up if you want to make sure you actually get your days right. The draft guidance gives very specific examples like, well, what about leap years? February's got 29 days, and is that the same as March? And what if it comes in on Christmas Day? What if it comes in on a Saturday? What if the due date is a Sunday? All these sorts of things. The ICO helps us understand in practice how the 1 month rule works. It also helps on this question of, can I extend for up to 2 months? Which, of course, everyone always wants to do. The grounds on which you can do that, multiple requests coming in from the same person, okay. But usually, controllers want to say, well, I need more time, please, because this is a complex request. The ICO tells us, well, it's not going to be complex just because of the large amounts of information that you need to process. That won't do. You also can't say, well, it's complicated because there are a whole bunch of other people I have to liaise with. I've got a whole load of processes working on my behalf with your personal data, and I need to contact them, and that's going to take longer. That doesn't count as complexity that will buy you the additional time, says the ICO. So do expect some pressure on that front if you are on the controller side. The ICO has made clear that those sorts of arrangements, those sorts of circumstances, aren't good enough. Circumstances that might be good enough include particularly difficult technical operations that would need to be performed that might need specialist input, where the nature of the data might involve lots of sensitivity, lots of exemption checking, and also, mercifully, the type of organization you are. There is a clear sense from the ICO that, from its perspective, it's not going to treat all organizations the same. It's going to understand if your resources are limited. Not going to let you off the hook necessarily, but it will at least take that into account. What about, on subject access front, the manifestly unfounded or excessive provision? ICO points out again, unfounded means malicious or no useful intention here, but you're not going to be excessive just because there's a large volume and a burden. That's not going to cut it. Likewise, what about bulk subject access requests, for example, from claims management companies or claimant solicitors that fire off bulk loads of subject access requests to the same controller. Well, tough, equally valid subject access request, nothing wrong with that, says the ICO. But more helpfully, the ICO does point out that if a complaint comes to it, it is going to bear in mind, take a realistic view of the burden that the controller is facing. I mentioned early on that data sharing arrangements were an issue, an area of interest in our modern data protection world. The case of M against the Chief Constable of Sussex from the last few months is an interesting and useful example of how the courts might go about scrutinising these kinds of arrangements. It's a claim brought by an individual, a minor, 16 or so at the time of the claim, or at least at the time of the events she was complaining about. And it was about a data sharing arrangement between a local police force and a business crime reduction partnership. What is that? That's basically local businesses in the area who are sick of individuals who cause lots of trouble on their premises. Shoplifting, theft, vandalism, damage, antisocial behaviour, that sort of thing, and want to be equipped with the information they need to spot and act on this quite quickly. So they set up a data sharing arrangement whereby the police force discloses under a specific ISA, information sharing arrangement, information about people that could fall within defined categories. The data included names, dates of birth, photographs, bail conditions, and apparent indicators of those individuals' vulnerability and their amenability to criminal or antisocial behaviour. The challenge was both to the facts of what had been shared about this specific individual, and the answer on that, for the court's answer on that front, was that it was okay. What the police had done was lawful. They had lawfully shared all of those types of information with the Business Crime Reduction Partnership. It was all justified, except that they had gone too far by sharing indicators of the individual's vulnerability. And there, one of the agencies involved in looking after that individual had raised the potential for her to be vulnerable to sexual exploitation. And the court concludes, probably unsurprisingly, I think, well, given the purposes of this crime reduction partnership, there was no need, it was disproportionate for that sort of information to be among the fields that were passed over for use. The other aspect of the challenge was, never mind the specifics of what you disclosed about me, the individual, this whole information sharing agreement is itself unlawful. It doesn't meet the requirements of the DPA. Again, we're in law enforcement territory, but equally valid insights. It doesn't meet the requirements of data protection law because it doesn't have adequate technical and organizational measures built in to ensure the appropriate processing of this kind of information. Now, here the police force just about gets away with things on that front. If you read the judgment, the court is just allowing it just about to scrape through. I think there are some aspects of the information sharing agreement that the court seems quite impressed by. Others where it thinks, well, that is, you know, that could be much clearer, not really clear what this part is meant to be doing, doesn't seem to be addressing children's vulnerability in any particularly clear way. So in terms of getting your homework marked, and the feeling that some of you must have if you work on things like legitimate interests assessments, impact assessments, information sharing agreements, appropriate policy documents, that sense of, well, the ICO or a court or someone might end up marking my homework going through this, and, you know, red pen, all these bits look good, these bits look shoddy. This is really what the court is doing in M, and it is a useful exercise it's a useful cross-check for you to see what sorts of things the court might look at. To give you some examples, the court looks at the security arrangements, it looks at the training that the recipients on the Crime Reduction Partnership side had, the purposes to which they were contractually limited in terms of how they could use the data and so on. It also looks at the legitimate interests assessment. And again, we're early days in terms of courts engaging with that kind of thing. An example of homework marking is something like this. The court looks at the section of the LIA that says, well, what are the negative impacts, potential negative impacts on the individual? And that section says something like, well, if the individual is kicked out of a shop, that's a bad thing for them, but they could be kicked out anyway. And the court understandably says, well, that's not really engaging with the question. The question is legitimate interests in data sharing and what are the downsides for the individual in that? So you get a sort of red mark next to it. As I say, overall, just about enough for the police's purposes to get home, but do beware of the kind of homework marking that a court might do. Last couple of very brief points. I've talked there. These are the points from Emma I've just talked about. Some pretty oddball cases on our penultimate slide. Just some curiosities that bob up now and then. From covert recording of a medical consultation. Can it be admissible even if you were a bit dodgy in having the recorder in your pocket? You said you wouldn't record a session, you did. Can you then deploy it in a clinical negligence case? Well, in this case, the court seemed to think, well, you've been pretty dubious in how you've gone about it, but, you know, so what? The BC case I mentioned just as an example, partly to give some Scottish case law an airing, but also because it touches on topics that do emerge in quite a lot of contexts. WhatsApp messages, if you're in a group chat and then you get involved in something dodgy, can your employer start to investigate and say, well, I want to see the WhatsApp messages, please? Here we're in a very specific policing context, so don't latch onto this and read anything wider across, but it does involve the court engaging with issues about the circumstances in which you might or might not be able to say these WhatsApp chats with my workmates attract my privacy rights. Last slide, how are things going on the ICO enforcement side? There, as those who keep an eye on this will note, the ICO has been doing a lot of prosecuting of individuals for data protection offences these days. There's certainly an increase in that. Where are we in terms of monetary penalties? Well, last stages of the old law, the Data Protection Act 98 penalties that are resolving themselves. There was a penalty just, it's January in fact, 500,000 under the old regime against DSG Digital for a point of sale malware attack. The Facebook challenge to the ICO's monetary penalty arising from its Cambridge Analytica investigations led to one preliminary hearing where the contested issue was whether or not Facebook should be allowed to run a bias and procedural unfairness argument and deploy that in its appeal as a potential knockout blow that would suffice to wipe out the monetary penalty. Facebook succeeded on the question of whether it would be entitled to run that point, but matters were then settled before the case itself went further. I mentioned in my last few bullet points the doorstep dispensary GDPR fine that we've had, 275,000. That looks a bit of a no-brainer as I read it. It's pharmaceutical records left in boxes in an unlocked yard. That's an early stage indicator of how the ICO has approached classic data security problems under the GDPR. There are bigger issues circling in the BA and Marriott notices of intention, which were the fact of those were published. That is still in the pipeline. At least no developments that I'm aware of as yet, but there's certainly issues to watch out for this year. I will leave you on one point, and again, it's not on your slide because it's hot off the press from yesterday. It's a first-tier tribunal decision dismissing appeals by Aaron Banks's companies, Leave.eu, the political campaigning organisation, and Eldon Insurance, both of whom you'll probably have heard of. They got into some trouble with the ICO through the Operation Cederberg investigations into use of data analytics for political purposes, Cambridge Analytica stuff, that kind of thing. Multiple strands and tentacles to that investigation. But the points I highlight as regards this particular case, the Leave.eu Eldon case, is they were fined 60,000, 45,000, that sort of thing, for PECA breaches, sending unsolicited direct marketing communications. Some of the interesting arguments that emerged in the tribunal dismissing those appeals, there was a consideration of the procedural challenge point, the point Facebook ran. Where the tribunal ends up in this new judgment is, well, yes, in principle, those points are available. But in the Facebook case, what was being alleged was extremely serious in terms of the bias and procedural unfairness, whereas what was going on in the leave.eu case was more of a gripe about what the tribunal calls the twists and turns of the ICO's investigation. And that sort of twist and turn level wrangling is not going to be enough to knock out a penalty. There is also discussion of what counts as consent to receiving direct marketing communications, what counts as instigating the sending of messages. And one interesting point that I will conclude on is this question when it comes to PECA and the type of communication that might land you in trouble. What had happened here was the individuals had said, yes, I sign up for a political newsletter. That's what I'm interested in, these Brexit things. So I want the political newsletter. But what they get is a communication landing in their inbox from time to time that is part political newsletter, but also really bigs up Arron Banks' insurance company's products, the Go Skippy. I think it's quite a sort of amusing discussion in the tribunal's decision about, well, why has it got a picture of a kangaroo in it? You know, if it's a political newsletter, the kangaroo is not political. I like that bit anyway. And where it lands up is an argument that says, well, come on, it mainly is what you signed up for. It's a political newsletter. That's what you said yes to. And sure, it's got some stuff about our insurance products wedged in the middle. But so what? The primary purpose remains the one you signed up for. No, says the tribunal. If you've signed up for one thing and you get marketing thrown in, you didn't sign up for marketing, that's it, you fall foul of Regulation 22. It's argued for the ICO by Chris Knight, who's not here today, but in a typical and wonderful...